You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
Well, good morning. We're going to start off with a little activity this morning. So, Alexis, why don't you put up that screen there with some pictures of some famous people. And in your mind, I want you to be thinking, what do these six people have in common? Let me introduce them real quickly so we know who we're talking about. Up in that left corner is Mozart, a famous Austrian composer. Next to him, Einstein, considered one of the greatest minds to have ever lived, equals MC squared, if you will. Next to him, Lady Gaga, supposedly an American singer. She's a crazy dresser. I think she's a little crazy, actually, herself. Down in the left corner, that is George Herman Ruth, also known as the Babe or the Bambino. Kara, he's a baseball player? Okay, just wanted to let you know, yeah. Next to him, Jimi Hendrix, great guitar player, considered one of the most influential guitar players of all time. And lastly, we have Mark Twain, American composer, wrote Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Adventures of, what's the other one? Tom Sawyer, yes. So, what do these six people have in common? Anyone? No. Left-handed, right, you know where we're going today. So they and 12% of the current world's population are, or in some of those cases they were, left-handed. Now this percentage is growing because it's becoming more and more acceptable to be a southpaw, to be a left-handed person. In 1860, which is only 150 years ago, only 2% of the population were lefties. And this is because for hundreds, if not thousands of years, it was thought that if you were left-handed, that you were in association with the devil. And so when you were young, you would have been forced to write and do things with your right hand and not your left. Today, we're actually going to talk about another left-handed person in history. We're going to talk about a fellow by the name of Ehud. And we're going to focus on this thought coming up right there. It says, just like God used Ehud's left-handedness, God can use our uniqueness for his glory. So our current point series is focused on the book of Judges. And just as a quick review, at this point in history, after wandering in the desert for 40 years, the Israelites have finally arrived at the promised land. They're settling into the land of Canaan. But unfortunately, when they arrived, they failed to fully drive out the other nations that were living there, which God had instructed them to do. These other nations did all kinds of things that were detestable to the Lord, including they worshipped idols. They committed sexual immorality. They even did human sacrifices. And God did not want his chosen people living amongst all this evil. Because he knew that they would be tempted to follow after these foreign gods. That they would be tempted to commit also these detestable acts. And unfortunately, this is exactly what happened. The Israelites turned their back on God. And we begin to see this spiraling cycle repeated throughout the book of Judges. Sean talked about this last week. Go ahead and go to this cycle. We're just going to do a quick review. So up on the top there, we have the rebellion. That's as the Israelites begin to follow after these foreign gods. And then God gets angry, and he hands the Israelites over to their enemies, which comes as punishment, or what he called retribution. Then the Israelites, who are being oppressed by this enemy, they finally cry out to God for help. So you have the request. They request God's help. And then God, who is so full of compassion, sends a judge. And a judge here, like he said, just simply means a leader to save and deliver them back to himself. That's the rescue. The Israelites then, they obey for a while and they live at peace. They live at rest. Okay, rest there. But then unfortunately, when the judge dies, they rebel against God again. And this cycle begins all over and it spirals out of control. Our story today is going to pick up after the first judge. His name was Othniel. So this is after Othniel dies, and we're going to learn about Othniel next month. And the year here is right around 1340 BC or so. This story about Ehud is really unique, and there's a lot of little nuances that you would not understand or that you would not get if you just read through it real quickly. So we're actually going to walk through this passage. I'm going to try to unpack it a lot because I find this story just really interesting. This is actually one of the reasons why I enjoy teaching, is because you really get to learn some of the Hebrew words, you get to learn some of the backstory, and it would be really my encouragement to you, spend time doing that in-depth Bible study at least once in a while, just to really appreciate all that these passages have to offer. So we're going to start off in Judges 3, verse 12, and we're going to break this down. I'm going to read a small section, and then we're going to unpack that, and then we're just going to keep moving on through the passage. So it says this, "Once again the Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight, and the Lord gave King Eglon of Moab control over Israel because of their evil. Eglon enlisted the Ammonites and the Amalekites as allies, and then he went out and defeated Israel, taking possession of Jericho, the city of palms. And the Israelites served Eglon of Moab for 18 years. Okay, so we see here, the cycle begins. It says once again. So there it is, it's beginning. Once again, the Israelites did evil. So the Israelites are turning away from the true God. They're turning towards these other gods, these foreign gods. So God, because of this, he withdraws his protection. So he allows this foreign nation called Moab to conquer Israel. Now we know that God doesn't totally turn his back on Israel for all time. We're going to read about that later. Because he's a very forgiving, he's a very compassionate God. But he needs to get their attention. He needs to punish them for what they were doing because of their evil. So who is Moab? You know, who are these Moabites that it's referencing? These Moabites, and you've got to put the map up there, Alexis. Moabites were a nomadic people that lived east of the Jordan River. So you can see there, these are actually the 12 tribes of Israel where they settled in the promised land. There on the left, kind of on the west side of the river, you see Benjamin and Ephraim. You need to know about those a little bit later. But then over to the east, past the Israelites, you'll see Ammon, and then down the bottom right corner is Moab. So the Moabites were this nomadic people. They lived east of the Jordan. They were actually distant cousins of the Israelites because they were descended from a fellow by the name of Moab. Moab was the son of Lot. Do you remember Lot? He was the nephew of Abraham way back in Genesis. Now, interestingly, Moab was one of the sons that was born out of incest. If you remember this story, it's a really crazy story, totally Jerry Springer stuff. But Lot's daughters, he had two daughters, they weren't married. And they were concerned that the family line was going to die off. So what did they do? Well, they got their father, Lot, drunk one night, slept with him, and there was two boys that were born out of that evening. One of them was the name Moab. One was named Moab. Okay, it also says, you can go back to the scripture there, Alexis, it says the Moabs got help from the Amalekites. The Amalekites were descendants of Esau. Remember, way back when, Esau is the one that sold his birthright. I'm sorry, he's the one that gave up his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of stew. And the Ammonites, Ammon was the other son that was born out of incest way back when. So you have all these people that are kind of like distantly related to the Israelites. And these three groups, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Amalekites, they were all enemies at this point of Israel. They had not been driven out of the promised land like God had instructed the Israelites to do. They band together, they defeat Israel. Jericho. All right, we've heard about Jericho before. This is the city that had been conquered by Joshua. This is the city where Joshua and the Israelites walked around it seven times and the walls fell down. This was the first city to fall to the Israelites when they crossed over into the promised land. Up until its defeat, Jericho was considered a symbol of military power, of strength. It was along this really vital trade route, so it was a really, really important city. The Canaanites thought that it was invincible. It was so heavily fortified. So it was a really big deal that it fell to the Israelites when they came into the promised land, especially since it fell by some walking around and some trumpet blasts, and that was it. After its destruction, okay, after it fell to Joshua, it was in a state of ruin, they think, because the Israelites had been told to abandon the city. They weren't supposed to live there. So at the time of our story, it's probably unoccupied. So when it says that King Eglon took possession of Jericho, it might have been somewhat of a symbolic gesture. Hey, you know, you took it from us back then, we're taking it from you now. Or also, because of its location, Jericho was considered a really strategic in controlling the lower half of the Jordan River, okay? What the comings and goings, if you will. Now, I just mentioned that Jericho was unoccupied at the time of our story. In fact, actually, after Jericho fell, it's thought that it was unoccupied for about 500 years. But archaeologists have found something really interesting. In their digging in this area, they have found that at one point during these 500 years, someone did live there. excavations have uncovered this really large building, this villa, like this countryside estate. And they determined that it happened, or that it was built sometime in the 14th century BC, which just so coincides with our story. So essentially what they found here was King Eglon's secondary residence, the place that he built when he came in and conquered Israel. He would have had probably a main residence over in Moab, over there in the east. But this was the place that he could also call home while he controlled his area or controlled his territory. And the end of our first segment says that Israel was under their control for 18 years. Okay? Picking up then with the next segment here. But when the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, the Lord again raised up a rescuer to save them. His name was Ehud, son of Gera, a left-handed man of the tribe of Benjamin. The Israelites sent Ehud to deliver their tribute money to King Eglon of Moab. So far in the cycle, we've seen the Israelites turn their back on God. We've seen God get angry, and then we saw God punish them by having them be overtaken. So what comes next? Israelites cry out for help. So after being oppressed for 18 years, the Israelites finally look to God to save them. You know, why did it take them 18 years to finally cry out and realize that they needed God's help? Well, it was probably stubbornness, I imagine. Maybe it was unwillingness to give up some of that sin that they had gotten so accustomed to. Maybe it was knowing that God was going to call them into a more pure lifestyle, that he was going to call them into obedience, and that always isn't easy. We don't know for sure, but they finally call out. God hears their cries, and he responds, because we serve a very forgiving, a very compassionate God. And how does he respond? He sends a judge, this leader by the name of Ehud. Ehud was left-handed, and this characteristic is going to come into play later in our story. It's actually a very important part of the story. Left-handedness is only mentioned three times in the Bible. All three times, it has to do with military stuff. And all three times, it has to do with the tribe of Benjamin, which is interesting because Benjamin literally means son of my right hand. It's actually thought that the Benjamites might have been ambidextrous. In other words, they could use both their right hand and their left hand. Anybody here ambidextrous? One? Yes. Maybe two? Yeah, I am certainly not. Another thought, though, is that maybe Ehud was crippled in his right hand, which forced him to use only his left. It doesn't really matter. What matters is that left-handedness is important. Why? Left-handers have a distinct military advantage. This is just the same way in certain sports. They have the advantage because their opponents aren't used to facing left-handedness. Left-handed pitchers in baseball are in great demand because there's not a whole lot of them. Just adds a little extra difficulty, if you will. Right-handers have far less experience fending off opponents that are left-handed. They have far less experience with those angles of attack. So Ehud was sent to deliver the tribute. Now, a tribute would be just some kind of an offering being made to the king. It would have been some kind of probably really high tax that the king would have charged them as their conqueror. But the word choice here in Hebrew is interesting. The word used for tribute is minna. Minna was the same word in the Old Testament that was used to describe an offering to God. Usually it was a grain offering. And so this should have bothered the Israelites because they were only supposed to make this offering, this kind of offering, this minna, to God, not to man, not to a king. Continuing on. So Ehud made a double-edged dagger that was about a foot long, and he strapped it to his right thigh, keeping it hidden under his clothing. He brought the tribute money to Eglon, who was very fat. After delivering the payment, Ehud started home with those who had helped carry the tribute. But when Ehud reached the stone idols near Gilgal, he turned back. He came to Eglon and said, "I have a secret message for you." So the king commanded his servants, "Be quiet," and he sent them out of the room. Now this double-edged dagger, about a foot long, other translations say it was about a cubit. It's thought to be maybe about 17 inches. This type of sword would have been very unusual for this time period in history. Straight swords were just beginning to make their appearance on this part of the world. Most swords at this time, at this location, were actually long swords. They were curved, and they only had one sharp edge. And it was strapped to his right thigh under his clothing. Why is it strapped to his right thigh? Because swords would have been worn on your opposite thigh, so that you could reach across your body, pull it out of the sheath, and then be ready to attack. Ehud is left-handed. He would have reached across his body, pulled it off of his right thigh. Now, at this point in the story, the reader, us, or the listener of the story, is starting to get a sense that Ehud might be setting up to be a hero. After all, he made this really unique weapon. He's concealing it on an unusual part of his body. He's really starting to dress the part of an assassin. You get the idea of like a male version of Jennifer Gardner in Alias. It was a great show, one of my favorites. Got a little weird at the end, but it was all in all pretty good. The Moabite king here, Eglon, is described as very fat. It also means meaty. This word was mostly used to describe animals in the Old Testament, certainly not people. And we get this idea that the king wasn't very kingly. He wasn't a warrior type. For me, I picture, Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi. You know, that kind of big slug type thing? That's the picture I get. Eglon's name actually means heifer. And it comes from the same Hebrew root word for fattened calf. So, if you remember, this is another interesting play on words. In the Old Testament, the Israelites would have sacrificed the fattened calf to the Lord. If you're an Israelite, hearing the story, you would have appreciated this play on words. You would have understood where this story was headed. Perhaps King Eglon was headed for slaughter as a sacrifice to the Lord. Just kind of setting things up. So Ehud delivers this tribute, which seems of considerable size because there's multiple people carrying it. But as his fellow companions headed on home, Ehud turns back and goes back to the king's residence and tells the king, hey, I have a secret message for you. Now, if I was the king, I would certainly have been a little suspicious about this. After all, it's coming from one of my subjects, one of the people that I'm oppressing. And it seems that his servants might have been a little concerned because the king has to tell them to be quiet. Maybe they were objecting to Ehud being this close to the king. Maybe they were just sharing their concerns that this seemed a little funny or a little odd. But why wasn't the king concerned? Well, and how did Ehud make it that close to the king with his sword, with his dagger? Well, you see, the king's bodyguards would have been in the custom of checking a person's left side. Remember, most people are right-handed. They would have worn their sword on the left side. Ehud's left side had no weapon. They also would have been looking for a long, curved sword, which couldn't have easily been hidden. Ehud's sword was totally hidden. Not only this, but in ancient times, left-handed people were considered to be not very smart. They were considered to be not very strong. So when Ehud came back all by himself, the king wasn't concerned. What possibly could a single, unarmed, left-handed man do? So Eglon silences his servants, sends them out of the room. All right, moving on. Ehud walked over to Eglon, who was sitting alone in a cool upstairs room, and Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. As King Eglon rose from his seat, Ehud reached with his left hand, pulled out the dagger strapped to his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. The dagger went so deep that the handle disappeared beneath the king's fat. So Ehud did not pull out the dagger, and the king's bowels emptied. Then Ehud closed and locked the doors of the room and escaped down the latrine. Another interesting play on words here, the Hebrew word interpreted message, where he says, I have a message from God, can also mean a thing or an object. So if you're an Israelite hearing this story, they would know that this is actually referring to the dagger that Ehud is carrying, not the message. So basically, I have a dagger from God. But Eglon doesn't know this, and he likely gets pretty excited to think that God was sending him a message. We don't know if he believed in this God or not, but hey, if a God is sending you a message, you probably want to hear it. Eglon might have been thinking, wow, this God is going to tell me how great of a king I am. Or maybe that this God was going to give you a prophecy of how to expand your kingdom, or how you're going to go into the record books as one of the best kings ever. So the king stands up, perhaps out of respect, to hear this message. And his standing up was probably no easy feat. He tried to squeeze his big fat butt out of his chair or his throne. And as the king is struggling to get out of his chair, Ehud pulls out that hidden dagger, plunges it into the king's belly. You don't find this story in the children's bedtime Bible stories, do you? The dagger goes so deep that the handle totally disappears. Remember, it's 17 inches long. Ehud just leaves it all there. And the king's bowels emptied. Now, this expression means that his feces came out. Kids, feces means poop. I think you probably know that. The king's poop came out when he got stabbed. Ehud locks the doors of the dead king in the room, escapes down the latrine. Other translations say he escaped onto the porch or onto a vestibule, maybe an area where people waited to talk to the king. But it's also thought that maybe he actually escaped down the opening of a toilet into some kind of janitorial room. We don't know exactly what the phrases mean, but it doesn't matter. Ehud gets away. Next section. After Ehud was gone, the king's servants returned and found the doors to the upstairs room locked. They thought he might be using the latrine in the room, so they waited. But when the king didn't come out after a long delay, they became concerned and got a key. And when they opened the doors, they found their master dead on the floor. So after Ehud leaves, the servants return. So it seems that maybe they agreed that Ehud wasn't much of a threat because they weren't waiting outside the door. Maybe they went and got a sandwich or something. We don't know. But if they would have been outside the door, certainly they would have heard the commotion. But anyway, they come back. They find the door locked. Now, they didn't barge right in. Why? They thought that the king was going to the bathroom. And why might they think that? Probably because there was this distinct smell coming from the room. A stinky smell. What smell was that? Poop. That's right, because remember, his gut's empty. The poop came out, so they would have smelled poop. The servants smell poop, decide to give the king some time to finish. And they waited. They waited some more. They didn't want to disrupt the king. Hey, maybe he was constipated. That happens. Maybe he was reading a really good Moabite mystery novel. You don't want to interrupt that. As a servant, it would have been really bad form. It would have been improper and insulting to find the king with his pants down. But after a long delay, maybe they got a little concerned. They yelled his name a few times. They finally get a key and they go in, open the door, see the dead king. I'm guessing things got a little crazy at this point. Last section here. While the servants were waiting, Ehud escaped, passing the stone idols on his way to Sirah. When he arrived in the hill country of Ephraim, Ehud sounded a call to arms. Then he led a band of Israelites down from the hills. "Follow me," he said, "for the Lord has given you victory over Moab, your enemy." So they followed him. And the Israelites took control of the shallow crossings of the Jordan River across from Moab, preventing anyone from crossing. They attacked the Moabites and killed about 10,000 of their strongest and most able-bodied warriors. Not one of them escaped. So Moab was conquered by Israel that day. And there was peace in the land for 80 years. So the servants waiting for the king to be done pooping gives Ehud time to leave the residence and escape. It says he was on his way to Sirah, and Sirah isn't really a known place, but we think it was probably just a wooded area in Ephraim. Ephraim is one of those tribes of Israel. They were located next to Benjamin on our map back then. But essentially, when Ehud made it this far, he could rest assured that the king's men weren't going to be following him. They weren't going to come after him. He was safe, if you will. At this point, we see Ehud transition from assassin to leader. You know, he calls a sound to arms. Other translations say he blew the trumpet, the shofar. This would have been a ram's horn. It would have been used in religious ceremonies. It would have been used as a battle signal. And then Ehud led this group of Israelites, we don't know how many, down from the hills and onto the plain of Moab. Show that map there, Alexis, just for real quick reference sake. There on your left, the west, you can see up there is where Benjamin and Ephraim would have been up in the hill country. And then this is a topographical map coming down and into the plains of Moab where the Jordan River is. That's what we're talking about here. Okay, you can go back. Ehud's pep talk to his army shows that he knows who is truly in charge. Because he says this, he says, "Follow me, for the Lord has given you victory over Moab." He knows that God, that the Lord, is going to save the Israelites, and that he, that Ehud, is simply the person that God has chosen to be the boots on the ground to lead the charge. The passage says that the Israelites took control of the shallow crossings of the Jordan near Jericho. Basically, what they're doing is they're cutting the Moabites off. They're not allowing them to escape back over the Jordan to get away. They're also cutting off reinforcements from coming over in Moab to help their countrymen. So just a good military strategy. As we can imagine, the sudden death of the king left the Moabites in utter confusion. They're trying to figure out what had happened. After all, you know, the dagger is totally inside. Maybe they couldn't figure out how the king died. We don't know. He pooped himself to death. Who knows? Maybe they're trying to figure out who now was in charge. But before they had time to process all of this, the Israelites were attacking. And we read, 10,000 of the best warriors of Moab were killed. Not one of them escaped. God often commanded the Israelites to not allow any survivors during a battle or during a conquest. They didn't always listen. This time it seemed that they did. The Moabites were so crushed by Israel that they're not mentioned fighting against Israel again for some 300 years in the time of Saul. And the Israelites then lived in peace for 80 years. This is the longest time of peace during any of the stories we read about in Judges. Go, Ehud. Now, what can we learn from Ehud? Well, remember, we're going to go back to our main point here this morning. The main point says, just like God used Ehud's left-handedness, God can use our uniqueness for His glory. You see, Ehud was an unlikely hero in his day, but that didn't stop God from using him in a powerful way. And this should be an encouragement to all of us. God can use us no matter who we are, because He made each one of us a unique creation, fashioned exactly the way He wanted us to be. He made our strengths, but He also made our weaknesses. He made our abilities, but also our inabilities. You know, we have been handcrafted by none less than the same God that handcrafted the universe. In Psalm 139, David says, "You made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it." So what does this look like in our daily lives? What does God want to show us through the story of Ehud? And we're going to kind of keep it short and sweet this morning. Number one, this is what I think He wants to show us. God doesn't want us to compare to others. He wants us to cultivate what you have. Ehud wasn't like everyone else. His left-handedness made him unique in a right-handed world. We aren't like everyone else. There's only one Justin Beamer. There's only one Chelsea Donaldson. There's only one Chris Hale. And Don would be so happy that there's only one Chris Hale, right? Yeah, he's not here, so I can say that. We've been each created with our own talents and abilities and uniquenesses. And as the psalmist said, we are God's design. We're His workmanship. I believe it's our job then to figure out how we use our uniqueness to serve God and advance His kingdom and bring Him glory. And doing this, I believe, is a form of worship. I believe it gives God tremendous joy to see us, to see His creation utilizing and growing or cultivating what we've been given. I recently saw a saying on a piece of jewelry. I think it's pretty powerful. I'm not going to buy the jewelry, though. Powerful statement. And it's something that I want my boys to understand, that we're going to certainly be talking about. And it's something that I think it's worthwhile for all of us. But it says this: your talent is God's gift to you. What you do with it is your gift to God. And for this morning, let's change it a little bit. Your uniqueness is God's gift to you. What you do with it is your gift to God. Unfortunately, we spend too much time focusing on our own limitations and comparing ourselves to those around us. We begin doing this if-then routine. If I could just speak like that person, then I could tell people about Jesus. If I was as old or as young as that person, then I could serve at the church. If I was as strong as Gene Bennett, then I could help my neighbor. Shout out to you, buddy. But we don't have to be like someone else to make a difference. God made us exactly the way He wanted to make us. And it takes all of us, it takes all of our uniquenesses to be the church that God intended. And we read about that in Corinthians when Paul talks about the church being a body and all these different parts coming together. Ehud could have easily gotten bogged down by the fact that he wasn't like everyone else. He could have seen his left-handedness in a right-handed world maybe as a weakness. But when he was in a position to be used by God, he was used mightily. Why? Because he was willing to cultivate the uniqueness that God had given him. It was only because Ehud was left-handed that he got past the guards and killed the king. So we need to stop focusing on what we can't do and start focusing on what we can. We need to stop comparing. The more time we focus on comparing, the less time we have to cultivate what God has given us. And it doesn't matter who we are. God has given us something unique to advance His kingdom. And if you don't know what that something is, ask Him. He will show you. Number two, God doesn't focus on our failures. He focuses on our future. We don't know much about Ehud's past. But if he was like the rest of the Israelites at this time, he wasn't living in full obedience to the Lord. There's a chance that, like many of the Israelites, that he had married a foreign wife. A lot of them did that. God wasn't happy about that. There's a chance that he had picked up some of the practices associated with idol worship. We don't exactly know what kind of life he lived, but we know that Ehud wasn't perfect. Well, how do we know that? Because none of us are perfect. I know, mind blown. You're like crazy this morning, right? We are human. We mess up. We miss the mark. That's what sin is. And we say things and we do things that we wish we wouldn't have said, that we wish we wouldn't have done. But if we have chosen to follow Jesus, if we have asked for forgiveness from Him, then God doesn't focus on our failures. He doesn't focus on our sins. Paul said in another part in Corinthians that as Christ followers, we have been made into a new creation. The old has gone, the new has come. As Christ followers, we can know that God doesn't focus on our failures. He focuses on our future. How are we going to follow Him? How are we going to obey Him from this point forward? Unfortunately, Satan would love nothing less than to have us think that our past failures limit what we can do for God. But that's not true. Our past, as messed up as it is, doesn't define us. In fact, our past, no matter how ugly it may be, can be used mightily for God. Because where we see failures, where we see shortcomings, God sees teachable moments. And God sees opportunities. For example, who better to talk to someone struggling with addiction than someone who was addicted and overcame it? Who better to minister to a couple that's considering divorce than a couple that was on the same path and chose to reconcile? Who better to talk to students about waiting for marriage to have sex than someone who didn't wait but wished they had? Today is a new day. It's time to tell God that you're ready for a new start. Ask Him to show you what things in your past He wants to use to further His kingdom. And then follow His direction. Because He's focused on your future, not on your failures. And then number three, we do these things so that in the end, we don't have a life of regret, but one of reward. According to Webster's Dictionary, regret is a feeling or of sadness or disappointment of something that happened. Or maybe a sadness or disappointment over something that was left unsaid or left undone. We all know what it's like to have regrets, don't we? Maybe it's that we regret not spending time with a loved one who then died unexpectedly. Maybe we have regret because we spent too much time at work and not enough time at home with our families. Maybe we have regrets about the occupation that we chose. These are some of the regrets that I have struggled with at various times in my life. And I'm sure you all have your own. These regrets can cause us a lot of pain. Emotional pain, relational pain, maybe even physical pain. But there are regrets that go far beyond ones that we maybe have regarding our families or our jobs. And these regrets are ones that we will have if we know that God has called us to do something and we don't do it. And that calling could be a ton of different things. You know, maybe it's stepping away from a stable job and a stable income and starting a new position somewhere where you're going to get paid less, but you're going to have more of an impact. Maybe it's a startup church and maybe your name are Sean and Kendra Fitch. I don't know, just throwing it out there. Maybe it's a calling that you're supposed to give more money away, whether that's to the church, whether that's to more kids in Oaxaca being sponsored. I don't know what that looks like, but it's going to mean sacrifice. Maybe that calling is that you're feeling that you need to get more involved here at Ignition or First Impressions or in Prime Groups, even though that's way out of your comfort zone. Whatever that calling is, if we don't follow it, we can be dogged by regret, wondering what God wanted to show us if we had simply taken that step of faith. Regret wondering how God would have used us to make an impact for His kingdom. And the only way to avoid regret is to follow God's prompting, to follow His leading. And to do this, to know that prompting, we have to be intimately connected to Him. That's through reading the Word, through reading the Bible, that's through praying, that's through talking with other Christ followers, working through things with them. And you see, if we follow God's prompting, we will be setting ourselves up for reward, not regret. And I'm not talking about any kind of material reward here. We're not talking about cash or houses or anything like that. I'm talking about the kind of peace and contentment that we will have when we know we are right where God is calling us to be. In knowing that we are fulfilling God's plan and purpose for our lives. And this reward is far more valuable than anything that this earth has to offer. Imagine, if you would, if Ehud hadn't followed God's prompting, His leading. What regret would he have felt knowing that he could have played a part in freeing his countrymen from Moabite rule? What regret would he have had in not helping to return the people to following after the one true God? And we'll never know that regret, because the story of Ehud isn't about regret. Ehud chose to do what God called him to do, and his reward was being the chosen leader, God's chosen leader, to return the Israelites to a relationship with the one true God, and then allowing them to live in peace for 80 years. So cultivate what you have. Don't compare to others. Focus on your future, not on your failures, so that in the end you can have rewards and not regrets. God knew exactly what he was doing when he created you. There's a famous bumper sticker that says, God don't make no junk. He has a purpose for you. He loves you. He wants the best for you. He wants to be a part of what he is doing here on earth. And he wants you to live life to his fullest. Because we remember that just like God used Ehud's left-handedness, God uses our uniqueness for his glory. Let's pray. God, we thank you for the story of Ehud, and we kind of flew through a lot of stuff this morning, but man, just a really neat story about how you took someone's uniqueness and used them in a powerful way. And I would just pray for all of us that we would just look at our lives, look at how you created us, and find that unique thing that you have put inside of us that we can do, or that whatever that looks like, and we would learn, we would seek to know how to use that for your glory, how to use that to reach people for your kingdom. And God, if we don't know what that is, we just pray that you would make it so abundantly clear to us. And maybe that comes through a friend or someone who approaches us and tells us, hey, you know, I see this in you. Man, I really think you should go with that. God, thank you for making us so unique. Thank you for caring about us and loving us so much that you made us so intricate that we are all so vastly different. It's in your name. Amen.